This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Kamal Debussy, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, well, what a message, hey? The book is called A Father's Plea. Kamal has spent his life working with community organisations for asylum seekers, refugees and migrants. He has been CEO of Western Sydney Migrant Resource Centre for 17 years. Wow. In 2015, his daughter Mariam was coerced by her husband into the grips of ISIS in Syria. She remains in a refugee camp today with her three children, and Kamal has been tirelessly working with Save the Children to bring them home for over 2 years. It's not just her that's there, it's many mothers and children, that are Australian mothers and children that are over there. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Yes. Yeah. We have our campaign numbers are 67, 20 mothers and 47 children. Though there's been a little bit of shifting with those numbers.
That's only a count of Australians. There'd be many others, wouldn't there?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to firstly let you tell me the story. And then firstly, so she's been gone how many years? How many years has Mariam been gone?
It was early 2015 that she left Australia. We actually travelled together initially to Malaysia, and then they went on to Lebanon and to Turkey. I came back. And so it's been since March 2015.
But you were working for the Western Sydney Migrant Resource Centre before then?
Oh, yes, I've been working for some time.
Isn't it ironic that your child, where here you are helping others and helping migrants in this country, and I think it's such a worthwhile organisation, the Western Sydney Migrant Resource Centre, and then this happens to you. Anyway, tell us the story so that all our listeners know what happened.
Sure. It is a complex story, and we try and simplify it. So my journey begins with a knock on my door by the Australian government, in which they coming to speak to me saying that my daughter was in Syria and that she'd been coerced into going. And I didn't know where in Syria she'd gone to. They didn't tell me where. They didn't tell me information about his family or him. They just said that she was there and they believed that she'd been coerced. And so the journey begins. I had a whole lot of follow-up questions. I'd been trying to contact my daughter. There had been silence on the other side. It was a little while later that we had realised that she was in Syria and got that confirmed. I didn't know where. I didn't know that it was in the clutches of IS. I didn't know whether she was in the FSA or the Free Syrian Army territory. You know, there are over 100 different groups operating in Syria. So it took me some time to figure out exactly where she had ended up. And so begins this journey of trying to gather bits of information. She had been monitored through all her communication with me. So what I've got was always sanitized. I didn't know that her husband had actually coerced her into going at gunpoint. Until I visited her in August 19 at the camp, I got permission, I fangled my way across. I did a lot of activity and effort to get to Al Hol refugee camp is where she was. And at that time, I was told that, you know, she'd been tricked to the border. At gunpoint, her husband had forced her to go across with my 18-month-old granddaughter at that point in time. The gunshots rang out and then that story also was verified by my son-in-law's mother, who was with Mariam at the time. He had coerced and put at gunpoint not only my daughter but his own mother and father and brother and taken them all into IS territory at that point in time. And it's been a journey of incremental learnings, of trying to get understand what's come through messages since everything is being monitored backwards and forwards, punctuated by a very, very large disappearance of my daughter. I spent 17 months not knowing whether she was alive or dead in Syria. The last, you know, I got a message saying that she was going to try and escape and leave. and then everything went quiet, nothing for 17 months. And I had actually thought that she had succumbed in that exercise. So she ended up, so she had, in that meantime, she had gone across. She was pregnant when she was taken across. Her husband died a month before she gave birth to her second child. A few months after that, she tried to leave. She was caught, hence the 17-month break. She was taken to a jail. She was forced to marry another IS fighter. We have a third grandchild, which we love dearly. He died. She was then made contact with me, but she was forced again to marry a third time. And then soon after that, she managed to flee IS control, ended up in the hands of the Kurds. This is where she is in today, in the hands of the Kurds. And so there's been this.
Do you know, it is such an extraordinary story of how a young Australian girl gets to that situation. Tell me about her and her life, because how did she end up with a fellow like him? Where did he come from? How did this happen?
Well, as I outlined in the book, actually, Mariam grew up. I think as I'm trying to point out in the story, Mariam's mother and I divorced when Mariam was in year six, and you know, late year six, early year seven, she came to live with me. She always missed, I think, the idea of family, and she loved the idea of large family. And as she grew older, she loved people more and more. She was a gregarious, outgoing young girl, and she loved people always.
Is she your eldest?
Yes, she is. Yes. Yeah. I have two daughters, and she's the elder of the two, so she became attracted to this guy who, when I met, was a sweet young guy,
an Australian guy,
same background, Lebanese background to herself, grown up here, gone to school here. Actually, to be honest with you, saw a fair bit of myself in him. You know, he was quite well natured, he was very pleasant, a bit undisciplined, but a nice guy.
And you knew his parents?
I met his parents. They were religiously conservative, but certainly nothing that I hadn't seen before or were worried about. And so whilst I got along with them, they were just conservative people, different to myself. Carla certainly wasn't conservative. He had a very similar sort of background and outlook in life to what Mariam had had. And they'd had some youthful indiscretions, as young people do growing up. And she'd fallen very much in love with him, and he had fallen in love with her. They had fought.
Do you think that there was abuse and coercion in the relationship that you weren't seeing or you weren't identifying?
No. I don't think there was abuse and coercion. I think I do go back and look at it to see whether or not there was – a young woman changes once she gets married.
Yep.
And I go back and I think, well, were those changes normal life changes, or were they sort of more untowards? I had to try and – be careful as a father not to be the meddlesome father-in-law or the meddlesome parent in that relationship.
Explain that to me a bit more. I don't know what you mean. Firstly, how old was she, and what differences were you noticing?
Okay, well, she was quite young. She was about 19 when she got married. She'd wanted to get married earlier, and I had actually said, you're too young. I'd gone through this exercise with them. But around the fifth time they said they wanted to get married, I said, well, either I acquiesce or they're going to do it without my support. So they get married quite young as well. He's only a couple of years older than her, so they're both quite young when they got married. Changes in her in that she'd started to attend some more community religious classes. She then very quickly put on the scarf, and I want to make a point. I have no problem with the scarf and the hijab. I think it was the speed in which it happened. I sort of looked at it and thought, that's interesting. And I quizzed her about it, and I spoke to her about it, and came away thinking, well, you know, she's gone in there with her eyes open.
And do you think that was coming from him or that was coming from her? How was he accepting these changes, her husband?
Oh, I think some of those changes he encouraged, and some of them were her as well. Certainly after they got married, he did settle down. He became a bit more like his parents. But it's hard, you know, the blurring of lines between, you know, the environment changing you and you being forced to change is a difficult line to draw upon. And people do life change. So I was trying to check myself, is this change what's normal, or is this change untowards?
I've been reading a lot. I mean, I've been watching that show on SBS about domestic violence. You Made Me Do It. I don't know if you've heard of seen that.
I'm aware of the show. I don't get a line.
And a lot of the conversation around that has been that, you know, he was a really nice guy, you know, I really liked him and the family, the parents, you know, who break my heart. You know, he was a really nice guy. And then they moved in together or then they got married and things changed. Do you think that that's a similar path?
The evidence as I go back and look at it all, no, I genuinely don't think that's the path. I think putting this together and still putting it together, the going to Turkey, actually, Mariam had some red flags there. So part of the issue about tricking her to the border was actually quite essential because had Mariam had an inkling of what was going on, she would not have got along with this.
Okay, before we get there, go back a little bit. So you had seen some changes in her, right?
Yes.
So she was becoming what, more religious or more fundamentalist? What were the changes?
I'd say she'd be becoming more religious.
Yeah, which is fine.
Which is fine. It's not totally unusual. Someone has a child and their life changes and things and your outlook on life changes and some of those youthful indiscretions become useful indiscretions, as I could put it them, and one grows up a little bit. So I wasn't particularly worried with any of this stuff. In fact, in some spaces, I thought that was quite a maturing process for her. Some things she started to come across that she was rejecting. There was a couple of things she'd seen that she had said, no, that's not right, and she'd pulled away. She'd remembered some of the early instructions that I'd given her, and so she seemed to be drawing a line around some things and accepting other things. So from where I was sitting, it wasn't a coercion. It was actually her taking on life is the way I'm looking back at it now. But I have gone back and looked and saying that I missed something, you know, that something happened that I wasn't quite aware of. You know, I have beat myself up a fair bit over those earlier days trying to understand, was there something there that I should have picked up on?
Right. So then we get to the stage where she's travelling. So I just want to work up to that. So she's taking an overseas trip with her husband and...
Much at my instigation. I'd said to them before they had their first child, you know, you need to go and explore life and travel. You see, you learn so much more of traveling. He had never gone overseas before. Mariam had gone overseas a couple of times, but he had never gone overseas before. Then she fell pregnant, she had a child, and before the child turned one, I'd said, you need to travel now or else this opportunity probably won't exist later. So when the opportunity came for them to travel, they took it. I encouraged it. I was going to Malaysia. They said they'd come along with me. I was very excited with the whole exercise and increasingly a distant son-in-law. I thought I'd give a chance to rebond and reconnect with
him. So you were feeling some distance from him?
Yes. I was just feeling a little bit of distance from him. He was working hard also, trying to provide, and I spent less and less time with him, particularly after the birth of the child. So, yeah, there was a little bit of distance that had started to grow in between me and he, yes.
Mm. And how old was the baby?
When they started travelling, the baby she was walking, so she was just over one at the time. So she was very cute and you know, I love the opportunity to spend extra time with my granddaughter.
Right. All three of you left for a trip.
Actually, the four of us with the granddaughter.
Oh, of course. Yes,
we left on a trip. Went to Malaysia. I did the conference. We travelled a bit, did the street food and whatnot. We actually went to Dubai together. I only spent a couple of days with them in Dubai and then I had to return back to Australia for work. So I left them in Dubai at that end, and it was a very difficult goodbye, but, you know, we'll see you in a few months' time. And
you didn't pick anything in him then? Nothing?
Oh, no, nothing at all. Nothing at all. In fact, we had a great trip. We went sand duning. We went the mall shopping. He wasn't much of a foodie. I like my food, so I started using some of the foodie outlets that I got. He was, the picture of a doting father. I did not pick up anything of his behaviour then that was out of the ordinary or something that I should be concerned about. In fact, quite the opposite. I came away quite satisfied from that trip. Hence why when that knock on the door came, I was absolutely floored.
Okay. So they continued on their trip.
Yes.
You came back home. And so how many weeks after you got back home did this happen?
Oh, we're talking a couple of months after I came back home. The knock on the door happened. So they'd been to Lebanon. They'd seen the families. They'd then gone on to Turkey. They were staying in a farmhouse in Turkey outside.
And holidaying.
Well, it was a holiday adventure.
But nothing untoward in that time. You couldn't feel that anything was quite not.
I didn't think anything was untoward. There was The only thing that was untoward was when they got to Turkey, apparently they were supposed to be meeting his brother there. That was my understanding. And his brother wasn't there. And I picked up, and Mariam got a little bit less quiet, and unknowns to myself, she had made contact to her mother saying, I'm trying to get tickets to come back to Australia. And Khaled was putting up obstacles and objections. I'd said to her, look, I'll come to Turkey. I'd like to see you guys. I was actually going to Germany, and I said, I'll come via Turkey. And she said, no doubt, if you come, then, you know, Khaled will say you've come, and we won't be able to get back to Australia for the foreseeable future. We'll just stay a bit longer. So Khaled has put some obstacles up. I think Mariam had a small red flag come up initially, because she then didn't make contact with her mum trying to get tickets to come back home. Khaled had found out, her husband had found out, and somehow massaged that so that wouldn't happen. And then from there, she settled down. I mean, they were in there for a few months. He found some local work. And what do you do?
In Turkey.
In Turkey, yes. He was an electrician. He found some cash in hand work. The adventure continues. And so, you know, what happens to people, I suspect, like all marriages, you know, your initial fears comes up, things settle down, those fears dissipate, and they were just exploring that different part of the world, that different environment, and enjoying where they were at was my understanding.
Okay, so then you're at home and that dreaded knock comes on the door. You had no idea.
I had no idea, no. The knock comes on the door. The final discussion was, I believe she's still in Turkey, and they said, well, we believe she's in Syria, and we hope you are correct, was what they said to me. We hope
who was they?
Oh, the Australian government officials that came and knocked on my door, part of law enforcement that came and knocked on my door at that point in time. They weren't difficult. They weren't, you know, they were just informing me and trying to get whatever information I had with me at that point in time.
And tell me about that. I mean, that must have been such a huge shock to you. And as a father, the fear and the grief.
I was floored. I didn't believe it. It took me a fair while to even comprehend what they were saying and that possibility of that taking place. And sort of at the end, I kept asking what evidence they had, what they could bring with them, why, you know, how they got to that stage. And I told them it was only recently I had, you know, recently, like the last couple of weeks, thought that she was here and this is the information that she'd given me and this is the discussion that we'd had. And I'd had a couple of photos around the farmland that they were staying at. And I said it just didn't comprehend. It took me actually a few days to start to really comprehend what they told me. It just didn't sink in at that particular visit. My younger daughter was in the house and she was upstairs in her room, so she caught most of that conversation from the confines of her room. And really, I think it was in my post-discussions with her that sort of cemented that there was something seriously wrong here, but I still didn't believe it until she confirmed it to me.
Who confirmed it to you?
Well, I, thinking that she was still in Turkey, booked a ticket and I was going to Turkey. I'd started getting some plans together and that's where I was going. And I kept texting her saying, I'm coming. And it was probably about 6 weeks after that when basically my bags were packed and I was travelling. Two days before I was meant to travel, I got a message from her saying, Dad, you've probably worked out something's happened. Be very careful what you say. Hopefully, as long as everything works out, I'll be able to still communicate with you. And there was a sort of this warning that came in to be careful as to what I do and who I speak to and what I say. And I think that was, she didn't say it explicitly, but the tone of that message had been very different to everything prior to that. And that's the message that I got from her. And that more or less cemented where she was. And knowing going to Turkey, I wouldn't have been able to do anything. I cancelled that trip.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The text messages you were getting before, were they really sent from her? Was she at that time in Syria knowingly lying to you, or was she coerced into lying to you?
No, I don't know. The messages that she'd sent, that message, that text message that came in from Syria, and these are, the timeline here is not exactly 100% clear. And in my communications with her, it hasn't been my priority to find out this message was sent from where at which time.
Yeah,
because it's been much more about her survival. But I believe that that message that she sent to me saying, "Dad, you've worked out something's happened, or you figured out something's happened. Be careful what you say and who you speak to." I think that was the first message that she sent to me from Syria. I actually think the messages beforehand were always from Turkey. But there had been a break of communication for maybe 6 weeks beforehand, and then they had another 6 weeks afterwards. So a total of about 3 months where I didn't hear anything from her. I think she'd gone across in that time frame. She'd been forced across that time frame.
How difficult was you to ring up your wife, your ex-wife, and tell her what's happening to your daughter?
My ex-wife, actually, I think my ex-wife at that time, Cheryl, I'm sorry, didn't feature strongly in my memories as to that first discussion with my ex-wife. I think from memory, said to her, "I need to speak to you," and went to visit her. I didn't talk to her over the phone on this matter. Mm. I think I went to visit her. And I actually think I went to visit her after she sent me that text message. So before that text message, I really didn't communicate with her very much at all. It was after that text message that I got that I think.
And after the police coming to your door, because imagine.
Well after the police came to my door that I went to speak to her, yes.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's terrifying for any parents.
Yes, it would be. And in fairness to her, you know, I can't speak to her mindset, but
no, I
don't think she's coped very well with this at all. And I think she's rather than trying to deal with it, she has a shutdown around it rather than deal with it. So it's just been something she hasn't dealt with.
So with the authorities coming to see you, I mean, you know, your daughter, Mariam, is an adult, right? So why are they sharing this information with you? Are they investigating you or, you know, trying to work out how this happened? How interested are the authorities in how kids end up that way? And how can we bring them back? Or what was it that they wanted from you?
Looking back at it, there was very little about the wanting to try and get her back or about how to return or actually what the motivations were that drove this. They really wanted to know about him and his family and his extended family. Unknowns to me, the family had been under surveillance for some period of time, hence why they picked up so quickly that she was there and that she'd gone. They were surveilling and monitoring their communications. They were trying to ask me for information about the family tree on his family side, his extended contacts, to which I was totally oblivious to. I knew he had a large family, but I really knew very little about the family and who was there and who wasn't there at that point. I knew very, very little at that point in time. But as it turns out, his brother was quite senior in the IS structure and they were fearing that...
And you didn't know that beforehand?
No. I had no idea before.
Well, they're not going to share that with you, are they? Yeah,
and the family didn't share that. No one from the family shared that with me. And as I've gotten to know the family, they're also mortified and horrified with the whole situation as it's unfolded anyway. But they were suspecting there were more members in the family here in Australia that might have been under the influence of IS, and that's what they were really much more concerned about than about my daughter's welfare or getting her back, really.
So I'm just going to kind of try and visualize if this was me, because I would have been, after the police left or the authorities or whoever they were, I would have been in an absolute rage. And I reckon my first point would have been to pick up the phone or go over and rip into that family. I just want to know how you controlled yourself and you dealt with that information, because really it is a parent's worst nightmare.
It is a parent's worst nightmare, and it has been a nightmare ever since.
Yes.
The impact that it's had has been enormous. I work with communities and I worked with disadvantaged people. I've had some social work training and that kicked in. And the first thing you do is you don't react. You know, you actually...
Well, I'll try and remember that.
You need to just actually, you know, everything that you're being told, you don't show an expression, you accept the information. And then my management experience came into being as saying, verify your facts before you act. You need to verify, verify, verify. And that's the mode that I went into, verify this information. I life experience maybe taught me that if you act without verifying, sometimes the facts are wrong and you get yourself into a lot of trouble. So I was verifying as much as I could before I could go forward. But then my focus went to be, I'm going to Turkey. This is gonna, I've gonna, you know, gonna correct this situation, whatever it is. So I started making contacts. I started speaking to people. On the off chance that she was in Syria, I tried to contact people that might know how to get into Syria because of the civil war situation. So I made a whole range of contacts, but that was quite useless because I didn't even know which part of Syria she was in. I had no idea where she was in Syria, and Mariam couldn't tell me where she was in Syria because that was one of the things that was being monitored. So I was trying to verify information. I was trying to get information, and then I couldn't. You know, it was.
So you think she was taken from Turkey to Syria? How is it that she ended up there? Like, at what point could she have said, "No, I'm not doing this," or could she have?
Well, she would have had. You know, he's managed to fool me. He's managed to fool his mother. He's managed to fool his father. He's managed to fool his wife. So he's managed to fool a number of people in this exercise. So the story goes.
And you still don't think there's coercive control there?
I think it's trafficking control. To put the missing piece in the story for you, Cheryl, already in Syria, unbeknownst to myself, I think Mariam did know this at some stage. I don't know when she knew this, but in Syria already was not only her husband's brother, but her husband's sister. They were both already in Syria. The news was, we've got people smugglers involved. We're getting our sister out of Syria. She's coming to the border. We're going to go and get her. She's been liberated from the clutches of IS. This was the story that was told amongst the family. So this is how he got the whole family down to the border to receive the sister, which was going to have this miraculous escape from IS clutches. So there's actually anticipation of joy and happiness, and the whole family went to pick them up. And of course, the reverse was true. Meeting them at the border was a group of people that had, you know, going to force them across, and they had to run under gunfire. So Mariam was much more of Khalid's equal, and had Khalid told her, "I'm planning to go in," Mariam would have, I think, you know, she is a strong-willed person. She would have seen this and stopped this. She probably had an inkling when she first turned up, but then a number of months went by and things settled down, or you know, a period of time went on to settle down. The trick was getting them to the border. And he, as I said, not only tricked his wife, he tricked his mother and father, and he took them all to the border, and they were taken across. The mother tells me a very similar story, and the only interview in which the father has ever been shown since the demise of IS is he says both his sons were brainwashed by IS, and that's the only hint that he's given in that interview.
So why do you think, I mean, you know, what are the chances of ever getting these people back? I feel that there is so many barriers here. There are so many barriers. Like, one, the Australian government is particularly the current one. I mean, you work for a refugee organisation. You know what we're like. We like to lock people up for a very long time for no reason. I mean, it just gives me little hope in knowing that the priority for government, the priority for a lot of Australian people is, well, they got over there. Why would we bring them back?
Well, I
first, just so you know, I don't feel that way.
No, I understand. And that are questions that have been raised and that have been asked, certainly. And I think that we need to clarify and put a spotlight onto some of this discussion. There is an inconsistency of the Australian position right across the board, but privately, we are told that they will make their way back home sooner or later, and there's an acceptance by bureaucracy that, yes, they are entitled to come home and they will come home.
Because they are Australians.
They are Australian nationals. And my daughter is only Australian. She's not entitled to any other citizenship either. My grandchildren are Australian. They're not entitled to any other citizenship. So they are coming home. My grandson will come home whether he's 3, 5, 15 or 25, and my granddaughter will come home when she's 17 or 27. The only way that they're not coming home is if they die. And is that really the position the Australian government is taking? We would rather they die than not come home. And I cannot believe that any any person really wishes for them to die rather than coming home. That's in their right mind. And so that's there's an inconsistency in the position. There is an acceptance that they will eventually come home. The barriers the public they've put up in the public space is that they're either a danger to get them home, or they're in that it's dangerous to get people there to bring them home, or they might pose a risk to Australia. But I do note that the government's quite inconsistent, because convicted men fighters for IS are being extradited to Australia. Women that are no convictions against them that are innocent are left to languish, and children, of course, have committed no crime and should never be put in detention, remain in detention. So there is an inconsistent Australian position. We have an offer from the United States which says that they will bring them to the border to relative safety for the Australian government to repatriate from the safety of Iraq, where we have consular assistance and consular services. And the official position from the Prime Minister is that this is a hypothetical offer, and that rests on the public record. I do note in Senate Estimates hearings last week that there was a statement made by Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in which they've said they're considering the American offer in relation to these women on a case-by-case basis. But we point out that the public pronouncements by ministers of the day is that whilst they acknowledge there are men that have returned and there are men that will be returning, but it's the women somehow that can cause mass casualty events and cause danger and a risk to Australia. So there is this demonising of the women and dehumanising of the women on a constant basis, but no language against the men. So there is an invested position of the government to continue to hold the line publicly. But privately, we do believe that there is plans in place that are requiring political acquiescence for things to happen. And we remain hopeful. They are Australian nationals. I'm very disappointed that the Australian government have sought legal advice, in which their legal advice says they have no human rights obligations towards Australian nationals in Syria, which I think is a really poor thing to have even sought. I mean, if you just consider for the moment the question that you would have had to ask, we are seeking advice to relinquish our responsibility to Australian nationals. That's the question they have to ask themselves. So I think that's a matter of interpretation. So there are legal steps that will be put in place. And at which point in the future will this crack and change? I'm not sure. It is stuck until it is unstuck.
Do you think both governments have the same view, or would you have a different view with a different government?
I believe, considering the amount of pressure that has been applied and awareness that's been applied, had it not been this government, I do think that government would have changed it. I do not think that, had the Labor Party been in power, there would have been a straight reversal. I do think that there would have been a fair bit of negotiation going on. But considering the government's pure objection to rescuing these women, exactly that, they don't want to be seen to rescuing women. It's an ideological objection. There is no human rights basis. There's no humanitarian basis. There is no logical basis for them to continue to be there, nor is it sustainable. Mm-hmm. When your key ally in the United States and your key ally in the region, the Kurds, wants them to come home, they will eventually come home. It's this period that we are holding them there is purely doing them damage.
How long has she been there with her children?
In the camps, in the detention centres, they've been for now two and a half years now.
Do you think COVID has complicated things?
I think COVID has complicated things by virtue of the Australian government being distracted. There's a lot of bureaucrats and a lot of officials that have been focusing on COVID. The irony is it actually would have been easier to bring them back during COVID because there'd been less international traffic. There would have been more control at the borders. There would have been easier access for them. They would have been put into quarantine on return, allowing state government services to intervene and discuss and interview them, controlling things a lot better. So COVID practically would have been easier, but the bureaucrats have been so distracted with dealing with other things that it's actually been this unfortunate disconnection.
Kamal, we're out of time. Thank you so much. The book is called A Father's Plea, and really I appreciate your time with me today.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. I very much appreciate the time and to being here as well. Thank you.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store.
We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.